Okay, yesterday we were looking at the representation of images in matrix format or vector format and some basic statistical characteristics that could be derived using this format of representation. Now note that all of the operations need to be interpreted on an element by element basis, even though the image is expressed as one entity, the boldface F, as a matrix. When you expand the matrix and perform the operations are indeed performed on an element by element basis. The expectation, the statistical operators apply element by element or pixel by pixel. So some of those will become evident as we go through the operations of transformations and convolution and filtering using matrix representation. Now, this may take the whole morning, and then we will see how we can use this representation to derive optimal filters and how optimization becomes fairly easy in this compact representation. For the ease of introduction of this material, it is advantageous to start with one-dimensional representation of transformation and convolution and then extend the ideas to two-dimensional data arranged in the format we saw earlier as a one-dimensional column vector. So let us start with 1D transforms. And these are just some basics that you already know, and we have already used the Fourier transform. But some of the notions are important in subsequent analysis. So let's quickly review some basics about transforms. So if you have a signal f of t over the interval t0 to t0 plus t, then you may expand it and represent it in this format, ak phi k t, where k goes 0 to infinity, and the phi k t are mutually orthogonal functions. That is, phi k projected onto phi star L. That is, the kth function projected onto the lth function. And because these are complex functions, you conjugate one of them. When you project one onto another, that projection, which is integral of the product, must be equal to zero for any one onto any other basis function, or this function, the basis will come later. And when projected onto itself, k equal to L, it is some constant C. And if that constant C is equal to 1, these are said to be orthonormal. Otherwise, they are orthogonal. So the functions are mutually orthogonal, which is interpreted to mean that they have nothing in common. And the coefficients ak are obtained by projecting the given signal f of t onto each of the functions that you are using in the representation phi k star t, the star indicating conjugation again. So ak is the projection of f of t onto phi k. The set of functions phi k is said to be complete or closed if there exists no function f of t, which has to be square integrable in the sense its total energy must be finite. That if you take the projection of f of t onto that phi kt, or take the projection of all of phi kt onto that f of t that we are considering, and if that projection is zero for all of the functions that you have in your set, then your set is not complete without the inclusion of that f of t also in your set. That is, if there exists such a function, then that must be a member of the set. So once you include all such functions, phi kt, this set is complete. And then it forms what is called an orthogonal or orthonormal basis set. And such a basis set of functions could be used to represent a signal in a transform. The Fourier series representation of periodic signals that you are familiar with uses an infinite set of sine and cosine functions, or complex exponentials, putting the sine and cosine together, at integral multiples or harmonics of the fundamental frequency of the periodic signal. So there, the sine and cosine functions are the basis functions, and all sines and cosines at harmonics of the fundamental frequency must be members of that set. Then the periodic signal, or any periodic signal, that is square integrable, that is it has finite energy, and there are some conditions on discontinuities as well, then the representation of f of t using this basis set becomes possible. The coefficients are the transform coefficients. Now, when you move to the representation of signals using vectors, let us take this 1D signal with n samples. Now, from the continuous domain, we are moving to the discrete domain. The previous expression was in terms of summation of the basis functions weighted with AK to get the signal in the continuous representation, and the projections were in the form of continuous domain integrals. Now, let's move to discrete signals, and when you have a one-dimensional discrete signal with n samples, let us write that as an n by 1 vector or column matrix. So put all the samples in a vector. And then the transform could be expressed as LF, where capital L is a matrix that has n by n size. So this F is n by 1, this is n by n, so the product is n by 1. And that is the transform, capital F, containing the coefficients. The coefficients could be complex, but we are arranging those values as a matrix or a column matrix. And the inverse transformation is written as small f equal to L star T capital F, where L star T is the Hermitian transpose or conjugate transpose of the matrix L. The condition is that L star transpose is equal to I, the identity matrix. So now the transformation can be represented in a very compact format. Capital F, the transformed signal, is equal to LF, where L represents the transformation basis functions written as a matrix. And the signal F itself is written as another matrix. The matrix operations are equivalent to the expanded summation in series format like this. F of k is the sum of LKN, the elements of the matrix Fn, on summed on all n. And the inverse transform is that, with k and n going 0 to n minus 1. We can convert this to the familiar discrete Fourier transform that we have already seen. So for DFT, let the matrix L have the elements KN, LKN, defined as exponential minus J2 pi over capital N KN. 2 pi is broken into capital N parts, 2 pi divided by N. With the notation W sub N is exponential minus J2 pi over N, just this part, then LKN is W sub N to the power of KN. So these are the elements of the matrix. The Fourier transform, the DFT, is this. We already know this. FK, the DFT coefficients, are given by FN, the signal, multiplied with the kernel of the transfer function, exponential J2 pi over N, of the transformation rather, KN, and K going 0 to N minus 1. If the signal has N samples, the DFT must have minimum of N samples. So this is the DFT. And all of this expression now agrees with the matrix notation. Then the matrix representation of the DFT is given by this. This is the signal F0 F1, F2, so on, Fn minus 1. The n samples of the signal are written in this column matrix. The output is this capital F0, capital F1, capital Fn minus 1. These are the DFT coefficients. The transformation, the Fourier transformation, is now expressed by this matrix, where you have this W sub n to the power of something, kn. The first row, n is 0, so all of these powers are 0. The second row, n is 1, and then you have wn to the power of 0, wn to the power of 1 multiplied with 1, 1 multiplied with 2, and so on. Here I have broken the power as kn, showing the multiplication or the product of k with n. So these are the exponential functions. W sub n is the, let me go back, exponential minus j 2 pi over n, a complex quantity. The power of that to the power to kn is what you have arranged in matrix format. Okay? Yeah.
So does the multiplication of each row and a column represent a basis function of the transformation?
The basis functions are arranged in the rows here. Yeah. This is the signal. When you take the matrix product, you take this and lay on top of a row. So you are taking the projection of the signal f onto one row of the matrix. So that represents one of the exponentials. For here, k equal to 0, k equal to 1, k equal to 2, so on. And those are the frequencies. Right? So you take this and take a projection onto the kth row, you get the kth coefficient in the output. So that represents projecting the signal f onto the kth basis function. So what you said is correct. And each basis function has n samples. Okay? Is that clear? Now, you have studied the FFT algorithm, I presume, somewhere, and there are some properties of the Fourier transform kernel that come in handy in the reduction of computation, in of the computation of the DFT. So because of the periodicity of the exponential function, the sine and cosine that make up the exponential function, we have W sub n to the power of m times n minus 1 equal to W sub n to the power of minus m. That is, you can take out an integral multiple of capital N, because that is the periodicity. And that is equal to W sub n to the power of capital N minus m. That is, you can also add an integral multiple of capital N if you wish. And the result is the same. Okay? This is because of periodicity. You can add or subtract an integral multiple of the period to the sinusoidal function, and the result is the same. And we have the property that W sub n to the power of the same n is equal to 1, because that is exponential minus j 2 pi. So that is equal to just 1. So for a given n, there are only n distinct functions, k going 0 to n minus 1. After that, you have the same things coming. If you remember the mapping between the Z transform and the Fourier transform, you will recognize this, but that will come a little later. Oh, it's here. The vectors or phasors that generate these functions may be expressed around this circle. The circle is the unit circle in the Z domain, or comparable to the unit circle in the Z domain in the Z transform. But you could also treat this independent of the Z transform. Each of these vectors represents the phasor that, when rotated, will provide the sinusoidal function. And these values may be seen as, in this case, W sub n, n is equal to 8. So W sub 8 to the power of various integer values, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Now these are roots of one, complex roots of unity. The value, the magnitude of this is equal to one. But for the various positions of this vector, we have a certain angle associated, which will then give you the sine and cosine. Combined, it will give you the complex quantity. So W sub 8 to the power of 7, for example, has this value for the x coordinate and that value for the y coordinate, or the sine and cosine values are given by the sine and cosine of this angle. So we have now 8 complex quantities with a certain cosine and a certain sine value associated with each one. These values are what are used here in representing the transformation, the DFT. So these values, the magnitude of each one is equal to 1, but there is a certain phase angle associated with each one. And these are called the N roots of unity, because they are the complex roots, and when taken to the power of N, they all give you the same value of 1. Using this property, we can now reduce the DFT matrix to a simpler matrix. So here is a signal F0, F1 to Fn minus 1. On the right-hand side, on the left-hand side, you have F0, F1, F2, so on, Fn minus 1, the capital F, which is the output of the transform, the DFT. The DFT matrix itself now is simpler. W sub n to the power of 0, the first row, W sub n to the power of 0, 1, 2, so on, n minus 1 there, and then W sub n to the power of 0, 2, 4, so on. And you have this representation, which is simpler than what we had before. And there is a further simplification possible. Let us consider n equal to 8, just as an example, a signal with 8 samples. Now, in practice, you will have hundreds of samples in the signal. So n will be equal to several hundred in a practical situation. But suppose we consider just n equal to 8 for the sake of illustration. We have the signal F0, 1, 2, 3, F7. And on this side, you have the DFT, capital F0, so on up to 7. The DFT matrix now, the subscript has been removed. The subscript n equal to 8 has been removed. And all you see here are W0, W1, W2, W3, W4, 5, 6, 7. That's all. There is nothing more here. So there are only 8 values here in this matrix. 8 unique values, I should say. The matrix is 8 by 8, so there are 64 values. But there are only 8 unique values that are repeatedly put in a certain pattern. So if you go back to the figure here, these are the 8 values, these vectors or phasors that are shown here. For n equal to 8, the circle is divided by 8 vectors. If you have n equal to 1024, there are 1024 of these between 0 and 2 pi. Okay, so these are the values that come into the DFT matrix. So now we see that the one-dimensional discrete Fourier transform of a one-dimensional signal may be expressed in the form of a matrix multiplication. The signal is written here as an n by 1 matrix. The output, the Fourier transform, also has n samples, n by 1. But these values are complex. Now, the signal could also be complex. In practice, we only have real-valued signals in most cases. But there is nothing that says this has to be only real. It could be complex. The DFT matrix is complex. Each one of these W's is a complex quantity with a real part and an imaginary part, cosine and sine. But this is an n by n matrix, and although it has n square elements, there are only n elements that are unique, and those n values are repeated. Okay. So now we see that the 1D Fourier transform discrete Fourier transform may be expressed as a matrix multiplication with the signal written as a matrix or a vector. Now we can extend the same to two dimensions. A little bit more work is required. 2D transforms may be expressed in this manner: fmn, the two-dimensional image, projected onto phi mnkl. Now, the output is fkl, capital FKL. So there are two indices in the input, two variables for the coordinates, and two for the output. So the kernel function has four variables. And the inverse transform may be written in this manner: capital FKL projected onto psi mnkl. But in practice, the psi will be the conjugate of phi. We will come to that in a moment. Just for the sake of generalized representation, here they are written as two different functions. The kernel is said to be separable if we can write phi mnkl as phi 1 mk multiplied with phi 2 mk, and symmetric if phi 1 and phi 2 are the same function. And we have seen this already in the case of the Fourier transform: exponential minus j 2 pi ux plus vy could be separated as exponential of the ux and exponential of the vy. So R, M, K, and NL, they can be separated. Then you can do the transformation in two different steps, where you do one applied to the rows or columns, and then another step taking the result of that and doing the transformation in the other direction. So this also we have seen already. So some of these I'll skip because these are repeating what we have already seen. In the case of the 2D Fourier transform, this kernel function is the exponential minus j 2 pi over n mk plus nl, which can be separated in this manner. And because they are functionally identical, the DFT is symmetric also. The kernel function is symmetric. Now, because of this property of separability, you may write the two-dimensional DFT as capital F equal to W, small f W. We do one transform on one direction, and then to the result, we apply another transformation. And that is expressed as a pre-multiplication and a post-multiplication by the same DFT matrix for 1D, where F now is in the middle. We have a few different representations here. So in this particular representation, please note, this capital F is the n by n image matrix as it is. It is not arranged by row stacking or column stacking. So here F remains as an n by n matrix. W is a symmetric n by n matrix as we saw for the 1D case, with the elements W and Km equal to exponential minus J 2 pi over n Km, the same as the 1D. And there are only n distinct values, but you multiply before and after. All of these are n by n matrices, so multiplication is not a problem. I mean, it is a computational problem, yes, but the dimensions match. In practice, your image may be 1,000 by 1,000 or 5,000 by 5,000. So these matrices are big matrices. So if you do this as a matrix multiplication, it would be awfully expensive in computing time, unless you reduce it using the FFT type of an algorithm. So this is the matrix representation of the two-dimensional DFT directly from the one-dimensional analysis we have seen so far, maintaining the image as an n by n matrix. Now, the DFT matrix that we saw just now, in 1D or in 2D, has this property that the rows and columns are mutually orthogonal. Any row or column is orthogonal with any row or column. So WMK, WML star, the conjugate, when multiplied and summed, will be equal to N if K and L are the same, or zero otherwise. So So this is because any sine or cosine, when projected onto any other sine or cosine, will give you that they'll be mutually orthogonal. So the integral will be 0 or equal to 1 if you're projecting it onto itself. In the discrete case, we get n because of the number of samples. And W inverse then is 1 over n W star. So the inverse of the matrix is given by just the conjugate of the matrix and with a factor 1 over n for normalization. Then the inverse transform, giving the image back, the small f, from the capital F, which is the Fourier transform, is W star F W star. The forward transform was given by W F W. Now you have W star F W star. That is what we do in the array representation too. Instead of exponential minus J 2 pi over N, we use exponential plus J 2 pi over N for the inverse transform. And that is W star. Okay? The 1 over n square comes as a factor of normalization. In the array representation, some authors put the 1 over n square as 1 over n in the forward and 1 over n in the inverse to make them look the same. But otherwise, you could put 1 over n square for the inverse transform and no scale factor for the forward transform. Okay? Is that clear? So the same matrix W that we constructed using the exponential functions may be used to represent one-dimensional and two-dimensional transforms, maintaining the image as an n by n array. There are a number of other transforms too that may be expressed in this format as capital F equal to AFA, where A is a matrix that is constructed using the appropriate basis function you want to use. And the basis functions could be different depending upon the function, the transform you want, such as the Walsh-Hadamard or the discrete cosine or other transforms, the Walsh transform. And they can all be written in this format. Using certain properties of the kernel function, in the case of the Fourier transform, the exponential function, the transform matrices, W or A here, may be decomposed into products of matrices with fewer non-zero elements. And that reduces redundancy and computational requirements. And the DFT matrix in particular may be factored or broken down into a product of 2 log n sparse and diagonal matrices. And that forms the basis of the FFT algorithm. So the FFT algorithm you would have seen in a course on signal processing perhaps, where you break down the exponential function making use of the periodicity and symmetry property. And that can also be expressed using properties of the matrix W that we saw. There are publications that show how to do this, and we will not go into the details here. Now let us look at one other transform, which is interesting, and that is the Walsh-Hadamard transform. The Walsh transform was popular in the 1970s and perhaps 1980s for image coding, data compression, and a few other applications, but it's not very commonly used. There are some interesting properties of this transform, which we will see. The orthonormal complete set of one-dimensional Walsh transform functions, or Walsh functions, is defined over the interval x being between 0 and 1 by this set of iterative relationships. So you start with a certain basic function, which is a constant, phi of x. I'll show you that in a moment. And then the next function, phi n x, is given by phi n over 2. You take the function of half the order and run it at double speed, phi n of over 2, 2x, for the first half of the interval, x less than half. And for the second half, x greater than or equal to half, you take phi n over 2 of 2x minus 1, or the negative of that, depending upon whether n is odd or even. And this representation in square brackets n over 2 is the integral part of n over 2. The zeroth order function phi 0x is defined as just a constant equal to 1. And then phi 1x, the first order function, is given by taking this for the first half and the negative of that for the second half. And then you apply the iterative formula, you can generate functions of higher order. Here is an example in the discrete case. With I'm using 100 samples. The interval is 0 to 1, normalized for the x-axis, or the time axis, if you want to consider this to be a time signal. So the zeroth order function, n equal to 0, all the values are equal to 1. N equal to 1, you take this and compress into the first half, plus 1. For the second half, because n is odd, you compress that zeroth order function and write as negative. For n equal to 2, you take half of that, which is 1. So take phi 1, which is this, compress that into the first half, which is the same. Positive 1, negative 1, positive 1, negative 1, for the first half of the interval. For the second half, because this is even, you take, just a minute, let me go back. Yes, if n is even, you take the negative. There. So you take n equal to 1, and because n equal to 2 is even, you copy the n equal to 1 function for the second half, but negative. Minus 1 and then plus 1. And then repeat that process. So you get these rectangular functions. But all the values are only plus 1 and minus 1. There is no other value, and these are real valued functions. So n equal to 7, you get this square wave with plus and minus 1 functions, values. Okay? So these are the first 8 Walsh functions, and you can easily verify that if you take the projection of any one onto any other function in the set, the result is 0. That is, take a dot product. The result is 0 due to cancellation of the positive and negative values. Now, how do you order these? Walsh functions are ordered by the number of zero crossings in the interval 0 to 1, and that is called sequency. There is no frequency involved here because some of these are, they are periodic when repeated, yes, but within this interval, there is no notion of frequency, like a sinusoid. If in the case of n equal to 7, you can see that there is a repetition of this pattern. But in this case, there is no direct repetition because there is the inversion. This is positive and that is the negative version of that part. So you can't use frequency as in the case of sinusoids. Instead, sequency is the term used to indicate the number of zero crossings in the function between x equal to 0 and x equal to 1. The basic interval for the representation of the signals. For n equal to 0, there is no crossing of the 0 line, so the sequence is 0. N equal to 1, there is one change, so 1 there. For n equal to 2, there are 2 changes. N equal to 3, there are 3 changes, and so on. That is called sequencing. If the Walsh functions with the number of zero crossings less than 2 to the power of n minus 1 are sampled with n equal to 2 to the n uniformly spaced points, you get a square matrix representation that is orthogonal. So here I have oversampled and I have shown more than necessary just to draw a nice picture there. Rows ordered with increasing number of zero crossings, you could put them in any order you wish, really, as long as you keep track of the corresponding coefficient. In the Fourier transform, we go by frequency of the sinusoid. Here, the sequence, or I shouldn't use the word sequence, the ordering of the rows of the matrix could be arbitrary if you wish, because they're all mutually orthogonal anyway, as long as you keep track of which coefficient corresponds to which basis function. But you could order the rows with increasing number of zero crossings, which is called sequencing. But there are a few other variations on this formulation. So if you compare what I'm showing now with some other reference, the ordering of the functions could be different, depending upon which method is used to generate them. So the matrix A, for the transformation that we wrote earlier, 1D or 2D, it is the same one. 1D you just write as F equal to AF. For 2D you write it as AFA. So the matrix A here is 1, 1, 1, all positive. Second row, 4 ones and 4 minus ones. One change of sign. And then you have this with 1, 2 changes of sign. And the fourth row, 1, 2, 3 changes of sign, and so on. I'm sorry, 1, 2, 3, that's correct, yeah. So this is the matrix, made up of just ones and minus ones. The Walsh transform of a signal, F equal to AF. Two-dimensional will be AFA. There is another formulation of the Walsh transform, which is a little bit more complicated, and it is not so intuitive. And this could be of interest to those who would like to see the bit pattern. Here, phi n k is expressed in 2D as 1 over n, the product of minus 1 to the power of bpn bp minus 1 minus pk, where the BPM is the pth bit in a capital P bit representation, binary representation of that number M. So this is minus 1 to the power of something, and that will be either minus 1 or plus 1. And there is a product of those values. That will give you phi n k. And for the two-dimensional transform with four arguments, you get this. I won't read that, it's not worth reading. There is a representation here that will give you the values of the function. The major advantage of the Walsh transform is that the kernel values are just only plus 1 and minus 1, whereas the Fourier transform has complex quantities that are between 0 and 1, that have values or components between 0 and 1. So in the Walsh transform, the computation is very simple. You just have to do addition and subtraction of the input signal values, which in most cases are real. And the operations are identical in the forward and inverse transform. Because they are real, conjugation doesn't matter. There is another formulation of the Walsh functions or Walsh matrices that are given through the Hadamard matrices of rank 2 to the power of n, where A2 is defined as 1, 1, 1 minus 1. And then A2n of double the rank is given by an, an, an minus an. That is, you take this as a block and write the block here, the same block, and negative of that block. So the 2 by 2 becomes a 4 by 4 matrix. Then you have a normalizing factor, 1 over root n. The Walsh-Hadamard transform of a 2D function may be written in the same manner as we have seen before, AFA, forward and inverse. And all these matrices in this format are n by n matrices. In 2D, the Walsh functions look like this. The Walsh-Hadamard 2D basis functions, they're just black and white for 1 and minus 1. So you start with a constant and you split this in half and arrange as we have seen in 1D, but now you have to do in 2D for rows and columns. So starting with a constant pattern and then half in half black and half white in the row and column directions, finally we end up with a chessboard-like pattern. Here it is 8 by 8, and black is minus 1 and white is plus 1. And this is an 8 by 8, or each one is an 8 by 8 matrix. So these are the two-dimensional Walsh-Hadamard basis functions. I showed you the 1D functions earlier. So these are just 2D extensions. I should say that it took me quite a lot of time to get all of this in MATLAB. I spent a lot of time coding this in MATLAB and cross-checking against multiple references to make sure that each black patch and white patch here corresponds to what I see in the other books. But then there was some confusion because the ordering of these is not standard. The ordering of the rows and columns is not standard, and there are some variations depending upon how you compute these functions. So I had some fun. But this is an interesting pattern.